Hi, Sasha. How's it going?
Good. We had our minds blown today.
We did. We really did. I did. I felt like I was talking to somebody from a different world. It was really, really interesting and really good for me because I was smashed out of my gender psychology bubble quite definitively.
We talked to Sasha Bailey today, and as you'll hear later when I read his bio, he has his hands in very different worlds than we do. First of all, he's about a decade younger than me, maybe younger than that.
20 years than me. He's 29.
Yeah. Yep. He's in the tech world. He's in the art world. He's in the fashion world. And of course, we came to know about him because he shared, well, the Daily Mail reached out to him. He didn't reach out to them to ask about his move from Tokyo back to the US. And in the process of sharing they said, we're going to write an article. Do you want to comment on it? And he told them a little bit about his gender dysphoria. So this is how we came to learn about him, because of course we are up to date on most desisting and detransition stories that happen out there. But the conversation went into so many fascinating directions, and you and I just recognize we're in a bit of a bubble. And we really need to learn about all of the fascinating conversations around gender and transition and transhumanism and the sci-fi world of medical technology that exists outside of our world.
Yeah. And it's important to note that he is David Bailey's son. That's why the Daily Mail, they didn't just reach out to somebody random.
Oh, yes. Who'd come true, back true. From Tokyo. And I didn't know anything about David Bailey, but you do.
Yeah. He's an iconic photographer. He's a very seriously influential photographer. As I said to you earlier, if you said to me, name a photographer, I'd name David Bailey. He's most known, I would say, for capturing the swinging 60s in London. So he would have, photographed the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Marianne Faithfull, Gene Shrimpton. And he had a really beautiful photography. Like, this is a very, very artistic photographer. Like, it's very top notch. And Sasha's life, I think, is clearly, we're kind of high art, high modeling, kind of, it's very much the art world he's in. And he's kind of mixed the art world with the computer world. He's very much of his generation. And like I said, I felt like I was talking to somebody so exotic. I think most of the time my mouth was a little bit open, just going, oh.
So everyone check out Stella's dental hygiene during this upcoming episode.
No, don't. Yeah, but anyway, he's a very prestigious photographer, David Bailey.
Mm, okay.
And so that's why he photographed the Cray twins and so many very famous pictures he did. And they're really good, like really, really top notch. But so no wonder. And Rudolf Nureyev, there's a famous picture of, the ballet dancer Rudolf Nureyev. Mm. David Bailey photographed him too.
Okay.
So then Sasha was born, and Sasha has kind of had quite an artistic life, and became an artist and an art curator, and has this magazine, FOMA magazine, Fear of Missing Art. He's a fascinating individual.
So cool. Yeah. Shall I read his bio and then we'll let you listen to the conversation?
Okay. I'll stop gushing.
Sasha Bailey started his professional life at the age of 16 when he left school after having dyslexia. He never really took to the rigid sculpture of the educational system, leaving as soon as he could. In his early days, he made his mark in the fashion industry as a model, being featured in editorials for many major fashion magazines and working with renowned brands such as Valentino, ID, Dazed and Confused, and walking for Dolce & Gabbana. During his time as a model, Sasha spent 2 months in Tokyo for work, where he fell in love with the country and made connections that would later play a big role in his art curation there. During his 20s, he began his career as an art curator and has curated over 28 art shows in major cultural hubs like Tokyo and London, and collaborated with esteemed names like Paul Smith, Damien Hirst, as well as working with over 150 emerging talents. One of Sasha's groundbreaking achievements was the conception and execution of the first ever NFT art show in Asia in 2021 and featured on mainstream Japanese news, Crypto Tokyo. This groundbreaking event showcased digital artworks tied to non-fungible tokens with notable artists like Beeple featured prominently. Beeple's artwork displayed at Crypto Tokyo later made headlines when it sold for a staggering $69 million, solidifying Sasha's position at the forefront of the intersection between art and technology. And by the way, I mean, you can really hear it in this interview today that that's, that's where
totally.
He lives. So in addition to his curatorial work, he's the contributor of FOMA magazine, which Stella just mentioned, where he's been working since 2020, standing for Fear of Missing Art. FOMA is a publication dedicated to pushing the boundaries of artistic expression and engagement in the digital age. As well, they've conducted deep investigations into online subcultures, of which we talk about transmaxing in this conversation. So you will be really interested to hear about that. In 2023, he fled an abusive marriage that he'd been in for 10 years when things came to a head and he believed that he was transgender. He returned to the UK after living in Tokyo for 3 years, leaving behind his life of friends and everything he had worked for. So we talk about all of this and much more, and we are sure you will really enjoy this conversation with Sasha Bailey.
Hi, I'm Stella O'Malley, a psychotherapist in Ireland.
And I'm Sasha Ayad, an adolescent therapist in the United States.
And this is Gender, A Wider Lens, a podcast dedicated to the shifting concepts around gender in our contemporary culture.
Through in-depth interviews, personal stories, and psychological exploration, we seek to open up the discourse around this hot-button issue.
Join us as we look at gender from a wider lens.
Hi, Stella.
Hi, Sasha. Oh, well, hi, both Sashas.
Hello. Thank you so
much
for having me
on. Welcome to the show. Yeah, we're very glad you're here. We have read your story. There was an article about your experience with gender dysphoria, and I know there were aspects of it that were probably covered well, and then there's probably more to say. So we were just really glad that you're willing to come on and speak with us a little bit. We usually go into some sort of a chronological order. So can you tell us a little bit about what your childhood was like and how you kind of came to experience some distress around gender? And of course, you have a famous dad who is a photographer in the fashion industry, and you've probably had a very interesting life compared to, at least compared to myself and a lot of other listeners.
So about that.
Tell us a little bit about earlier you.
Growing up, I had a really good childhood overall. My parents were lovely. I think I had a lot of good values instilled in me. But, you know, despite that, unfortunately, I suffered sexual abuse as a child. And I think that's something that was missed out of the Daily Mail article, which kind of made me sound like I just picked up gender dysphoria. But as a child, generally, I was happy. But I do remember bouts of not wanting to be myself, wanting to be someone else. I don't know if I knew exactly what they meant at the time, or I don't know if they even mean that now, but it was more just kind of throughout that these sort of feelings came up, and then you don't really pinpoint them. And then around puberty, I guess you start to have more of an idea of what those feelings mean. So at that point, it became something where, oh, okay, it's gender dysphoria, mainly because of things that I've read online. But then as I grew up, later on, these feelings, they do go away, and they usually only come back when there's high levels of stress or there's some sort of situation that I want to escape or something like that. And I think that's relatively common. So that's the short of my story.
And did you kind of, were you a feminine little boy?
Somewhat. If you look at pictures of me online, you would think I was a little girl. But I wasn't dressing in, my sister used to dress me up in girls' clothes. But other than that, it wasn't something I actively did. I just had an older sister. I think that's quite a normal thing if you have an older sister.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. And so you kind of said that it came and went. I see it as relapse. I see that coming and going, times of stress as relapse. But it's a funny way you've described it, because I had my own gender issues as a kid, and usually when it's childhood, it's full in, all in. But it doesn't sound like that with you, if you follow me. Usually they you know what I mean? They're singing from the rooftops usually.
I think as well.
You came from an I wonder, like, maybe with your father being photographer, it might have been very unconventional. Maybe that was part of it. I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah, I think as well, being in that background and around that stuff, it probably did make it harder for me to talk about it. But I'm glad that I didn't, because I think I would have made a mistake. And I had these kind of problems, but like I said, they would subside. They're something that was, I'd think about it, but then I'd swiftly move on to kind of doing something else or playing like a child could. But it was something to come up. It's difficult because it was when it came full force, it is something, it's quite an intense feeling. And then I remember thinking, you know, when I was around 16, oh, if I don't do this now, then I'm probably going to regret it later. But the opposite is true.
Yeah. Wow. You also talked about a sort of relationship to what you had experienced as a child in terms of sexual abuse. And before we started recording, you kind of used the word escape. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the fantasy of being a girl or becoming a girl, and the way that that is an escape. You know, at least from my experience with males who experience gender dysphoria, there's often an escape from some sort of sexuality related issue. And of course, you kind of shared with us that you had been through something really difficult. So can you talk about the way this fantasy of becoming a girl was an escape for you?
Well, so I think it's about having, as a kid, when you're molested, it's about, you've had something taken from you. You've had something that was yours taken from you. You've had your ability to feel comfortable as a man, in my case, kind of sexually taken from you. So the way to reclaim that is, I guess, you want to be the opposite, because in your mind, or at least in the kind of the way, I guess, the mental gymnastics that one's mind goes through, it makes sense to remove the part of you that was sexual and move into another form. But I do also think it speaks volumes to how important environment is in all of this, because the environment you're in, you can change it. And often when you change your environment, it changes, you know, your perceptions of the world. And that's also something that I think, you know, we'll get to that stopped me from doing it. But I think, like, so a lot of the time, there's a lot of people who can't change their environment that are thinking about this. And if you can't, especially, you know, when you're younger, you have no control over your environment. It's very hard to know how you feel about the world around you and how that, in reference to yourself, is meaningful. I think human beings, you know, want to solve problems. And if you're in a situation where the issue is so difficult and so impossible to solve with the person that you are, rather than you trying to find a new way to solve the problem because you can't, you'll change yourself so you can solve the problem. So you're now fit for purpose for that problem. And I think what goes through a lot of people who suffer with gender dysphoria and a lot of other conditions is, I'm not good enough. Something's wrong with me. And then that becomes like a, you know, that becomes almost a maxim. That becomes something that's stuck inside your head.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think the altering of environment is so important.
Can you link that for us? Because you said something very profound, that with gender dysphoria or other issues, a person comes to believe, I don't have the tools to solve this. If I become another person, I'll become more capable, right? How does the environment play into that? Because it seems like that's an important piece.
So I guess an example would be, you know, you're stuck in a place where, what would be a good example? So yeah, you're stuck in a place where you cannot solve this issue. Okay, for instance, for the magazine I run, Phone Mag, we did an issue where we investigated trans maxers, because that was a big thing that was going around. And they're essentially people who are transitioning for functional purposes for the most part. And they're very open. I've interviewed a lot of them. There's, you know, I have recordings, everything. They're available online. But they're very honest about solving kind of a functional problem. And one of them said something, which is an example of this, is they wanted to be included in STEM initiatives. And all of the STEM initiatives at their school were for women only. So he didn't care much about transitioning, or she now, but it was functional. This person was high functioning, autistic, but they saw it as a way to get into the class that they wanted to get into, so they could learn. So that's a kind of, you know, a micro example of it, but that's the one that comes to mind. Actual anecdotal.
Wow.
So you're saying that when the environment creates incentives, it can have a big impact on how a person like makes sense of their circumstances and what strategies they have to find solutions.
Exactly. And in the end, it's all, you know, it's all incentives. I think the people who started medically transitioning at the start probably got some very positive things out of it, and it was very good for them. Then they're an example. Society rewards them. That's good. It's good that we're open, and that's a good thing. But what happens is then they become heroes, and then some people look towards that, and they're not thinking with the eyes of gender dysphoria. They're thinking in the eyes of something is wrong with me, that fundamental thought that most human beings have. Yeah. And, oh, this person solved their problems by doing this. But not only have they solved their problems, they've got all these accolades, they've got all of these financial benefits, they've got all of this stuff. So then you start attracting people who are doing it for the wrong reason. And they'll be disappointed because it's, you know, becoming normalized, that they won't receive all of those accolades. And that's, in without knowing it, I think a lot of people are choosing to transition for that rather than the honest reason of being transgender. And whether they know it for sure or not, I think a lot of people don't realize in the back of their minds there's that I am not good enough. This is a way of solving that problem.
And when, there's one question I'd like to ask that I just want to clarify. So when you were a kid and it would kind of come as a, almost a fleeting thought that you just chose not to indulge, you kind of had mental self-discipline saying, I'm not going down that road. There's something about that makes me think, did you think I want to be a girl, or did you think I want to transition, if you follow me?
When I was a kid, I wanted to be a girl. As I went to a teenager, I wanted to transition. And as an adult, when I recently went through what I went through, it was very much, I want to transition. It wasn't necessarily that I wanted to be a woman. But as a kid, before you have a concept of really what gender is, I think it was more, I want to be female.
Okay.
There is this big conversation happening in our world right now about what are the accurate motivations for males to transition. And the debate usually revolves around, is this an autogynephilic experience, which I'm assuming you've heard of that term? Is this a homosexual, transsexual? But what you said a few moments ago is almost like a game theory understanding of transition as like gaining social incentives. And I've heard people talk about this somewhat, but I really haven't heard this fleshed out. And I'm aware that you're also, you developed a blockchain site for art. So you are like, you have this kind of computer oriented programmy brain, which we certainly don't have. We're always talking about the emotions and the underlying trauma or whatever. But I'm like really curious about this because within the world of programming and computer science, there's a ton of people transitioning.
Yeah, and it's theory, massively overrepresented.
Yeah, and I think the theory is, well, they're all autogynephilic, which might be true, but you're raising this totally different hypothesis, and I'm fascinated by it.
It's almost like you're an exotic bird because we're like, this is a new direction.
I think it's... Yeah, I think it's funny you say that because it's something that I thought about a lot because it is massively overrepresented in the tech industry. And another thing that the same trans maxer who I spoke to said was originally they were actually just trying to get rid of their libido entirely because it annoyed them. So
will you explain to people what a trans maxer is, just for anybody who won't know?
So a trans maxer is it's a Discord group. It had about 1,500 members at one point, but it's also a online kind of movement they have a 74 page or 64 page manifesto, which genuinely has some incredible data in there. They've collected some interesting data sets, but it's essentially a purely functional argument for transitioning. And I went and interviewed these people. This is not to say that was my reasoning, because I think I had more than just those basic things, but I do think that there is a growing group of people who, it's almost as if a lot of the people in tech already view their bodies as vehicles. It's kind of like, I think a lot of those people are already living in the future. So they've already decided that, okay, well, my physical body doesn't really matter. I'm constantly jumping in and out of avatars. I'm constantly doing whatever, you know, my profile picture on Twitter is more me in some ways. So they want to modify their bodies, or they feel uncomfortable in the real world. And that same saying, I am not good enough, comes up, and then they think, well, I can improve myself this way, or this will make it better for me, or it will, you know, there's a load of different reasons. I genuinely think there's as many reasons for people to transition as there are people. But the broad spectrum of them, I think, is all of this. And the autoerotic gynophilia aspect, I do think, comes into it for in some way, because I actually find that one quite difficult to reason with, because it's so broad. Because if you think about it, if you're turning your, you know, for whatever reason, mm-hmm. you want to transition, at the same time, everyone's saying, you know, love yourself, all of this sort of stuff. So to me, I feel like that it's almost a default. It doesn't feel like part of the argument. It just feels like it's kind of a result of thinking and of doing that thing one would be. You know, you would hope that you like yourself as the other gender if you're transitioning. So I do feel like that one in itself is more like a symptom in a wider thing. I don't necessarily think it's the core reason. I really do think, the people in tech, a lot of them would be, they'll have functional reasons and emotional reasons, but the functional reasons will probably outweigh the emotional reasons.
And they're very disconnected from their body, I'm gathering.
I mean, if you're on a computer all day and you're in the screen, you know, you do kind of, anyone who's typing for a long time, you do kind of have an out-of-body experience when you're just immersed inside the world. So I think that's more and more common for people. And, you know, for whatever reason, there's certain avatars that people like to use. And I imagine that, you know, if you're deep into it, like VR, all of that stuff, it can become very confusing. And you then end up reflecting what you do in this virtual world in real life. But I think more for coders and stuff, it's more just they're very functional people. And, you know, I don't know how to say this without, I don't want it to come across bad, but, you know, one argument could be that your company just says, as a quota, right, we need to hire more women. And someone who really doesn't mind what their body looks like goes, oh, I can solve that problem. So, like, that's what I mean, is I do think there's this functional problem-solving argument going on. And the more incentives we lay out in society for it, the more people will seek to solve the problem functionally.
I want to say, too, because I'm very close to several people who work in tech. And one of these people, she's a woman, and she was telling me about these regular meetings of all the females in her company that are there to talk about, like, women in tech issues and how they're all so mad that the men are totally underqualified and totally overpaid. And they become these kind of sessions where the women are really airing frustrations. And I can only imagine, like, if you are a male in tech and you're aware that these conversations are happening, there's another incentive not to be seen as this asshole who's overpaid and underqualified, which, like, I'm sure there are some, but I imagine that this can generalize and kind of stain a bunch of men who maybe are quite qualified or something. So this is very interesting. When I heard her talking about these meetings, I thought, oh, I wonder what this is going to do to the dynamic. And then you have all of these men sometimes in quite high positions, like transitioning out of the blue. And then all of a sudden they are now this like exotic and also minority status person who's kind of regained their respect in the eyes of the coworkers. So what do you think about that?
I think that's true, but I do also think the phenomenon with people in high stress situations is just, it's an escape thing, and then maybe they're predisposed to going towards gender dysphoria when they're trying to escape. So I do think that's part of it. But yeah, I also think it's like, if you get a lot of people who like to solve problems, they're going to solve a problem, whatever it takes. Like, they're not necessarily thinking in those ways. And I think that is just because the incentives we lay out in society, and we have to be careful, because once we turn kind of a machine on that's incentive driven, it's very hard to stop it. So, for instance, pharmaceutical companies play a big part in this argument, whether we know they do or not. And a lot of people at pharmaceutical companies are probably just thinking, great, we've sold more menopause medication. That's good. Numbers gone up. Mm. We're now going to hire more people for that division. We're going to spend more money on that division. now suddenly there's children who are relying on it to eat. There's families that are relying on this division existing. And the CEO is being told, you know, oh, it's a good thing, so I'll continue to do this. But by the time anything, you know, there's a stop to it or anything stops in its tracks, it's become this incentive-driven machine that just cannot be stopped because these people have to eat. These divisions have to exist. This medication has to keep selling. So we have to keep growing it. And then, yeah, that's what I think is we've laid out some really weird incentives in the world, and it's causing a problem. And there's a clash. You know, like I said, you can't have a reasonable conversation about this a lot of time. And I think, you know, I'd hazard a guess that a lot of that is to do with lobbying and making it toxic on purpose, because pharmaceutical companies want to defend their bottom line. I really think, you know, it's not all that, but I do think they play a big part in this argument that isn't talked about.
And would you have thought of much of this before you decided to transition? Where were you about trans issues pre your
weirdly? Weirdly, I was watching a lot of Blair White and Ben Shapiro at the time, but I still wanted to do it because I thought, you know, this is still me. This is still what I want to do. I then ended up on the kind of trans forums and things like that, and it just kind of spiraled from there. But my mind, in a weird way, my mindset was already this, but I didn't care because it was the thing I wanted to do. So I didn't care that the pharmaceutical companies would be profiting off me. Oh, I still wanted to do it. If anything, in that mindset, if anything, it's good. Glad they're profiting because that means I get what I want faster. So
it's very strategic. I mean, there's something... I don't want to say refreshing because that's not the right word, but I find it really interesting and intriguing to just hear a very direct kind of strategic, systematic decision-making process here, which is from like the ROGD girls and the detransitioners we hear from a lot, which have like these very deep things they have to unearth. And I'm sure there are deep things, obviously. I mean, you shared some really intimate things that you've been through, but... it's very interesting to just hear your angle on this.
Yeah, I feel like it's, I feel to some people it is analytical, but again, like I said, I don't think I fit into the camp of people doing it for purely incentive reasons. I think that it was very emotional for me. Yeah. I just think that the reason I want to come in here and talk about it in a functional way is I feel like that's not the argument that's been heard. That's not the voice that's been heard, is we are talking about this from an emotional standpoint. And, people who are assigned male at birth generally have more of a functional mindset. So
yeah.
I think that that's a conversation that we do need to think about. I mean, you can see examples without naming them exactly, but I'm sure your audience will know what I'm talking about. You can see examples of people doing this for functional reasons all over the place in competitive, all sorts of things. So it is kind of, to me, glaringly obvious that that is there.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
So male.
Yeah. We need way more males talking about this. I mean,
yeah.
Women's voices have been pretty prominent here. Of course, we've had some male reporters and physicians. Like, we've had a lot of males talking about this too, but this is great. So maybe we can kind of continue with your story, and then we'll end up probably back here into these more theoretical pieces. So you had this experience as a child. You had these fleeting thoughts, particularly more intense during periods of stress, about wanting to, initially it was, I want to be girl. Then it became, I want to transition. And then it became, this is what I want, even if I can analytically recognize the way I'm being, you know, a pawn in this machine, like, that's fine. I just want it. Tell us, like, what was going on in your life to where you kind of crossed that Rubicon from, this is a thought I've had on and off for my whole life, to like, this is something I'm going to do now.
So I was in an extremely toxic and abusive marriage. And then towards the end, I guess I was very isolated. I was living in Tokyo. I was completely alone, pretty much. I had a couple of English friends, or a couple of people who could speak English. I can't speak fluent Japanese, so it was very hard to connect to people. I can have conversations, but I can't emotionally connect with anyone.
Yeah.
So I was very alone, and I think with what I was going through, this kind of protective thing that existed as a child reared its head, and I became, rather than it just being something that fleeting moment, I kind of became that other personality or whatever it is, in not in, you know, so dramatic terms, but more like an overlay, more like something that was protective. And then I just decided that it was what I wanted to do. I think I spent a few days laying in bed just before. I did actually, I mean, going back a bit, I did actually attempt to, we're on YouTube, right, to exit game myself. So before that. And then, yeah, after I came around to it, I just felt like that was the way out. That was the solution.
Stella, so we'll get taken off YouTube if he says, but he had made attempt.
Yeah, that's, you know, to unplug the Xbox, as YouTube friendly way of saying it. And then after that, I kind of came back around and it felt like the only solution. In hindsight, it was a way of doing that act without doing it, because I was still erasing the me that existed. I started quite quick. I started wearing body shaping corsets almost immediately. I started exercising, doing the exercise that you needed to. I started moving towards quitting smoking because that supposedly affects the intake of hormones. So, I started doing all of the things to prepare myself for it. And then I got an appointment.
And as a matter of interest, did you know the pathway you were going to go down? Did you know what hormones were? Did you know what you were going to? Had you thought
exactly
a lot about all that?
Yeah, I knew I wanted hormones. So that was my priority to get that. So I went to an open day in Nagoya. There's a plastic surgery thing. I don't want to name them for various reasons. Mm-hmm. But I went there and I got diagnosed by... So the guy who came in... to do the diagnosis was there for like an open day, and I went and saw the surgeon. He put me in the room with a psychologist who couldn't speak English. We spoke through one of those little boxes from like the 2000s, like the really early days translation boxes. I mean, it's funny on hindsight, but it's awful. And then within 10 minutes, I was quite emotional, and within 10 minutes I was diagnosed, and then I was given a box of, I still have a box of, the patches, which are like, I think the 79 milligram estrogen or whatever it is, the standard ones. And then, kind of sent on my way. And then I was booked in for, I had my blood taken, and 1 month later I was going to have my hormones checked. So he was going to let me take the medication before even checking my hormone levels, which is, yeah. And then, I came literally, the only reason I didn't, start the treatment was because there was a massive kind of explosion in my my marriage, and I fled Japan. And then I was still wanting to do it when I came back, but the NHS is very slow here, so that guess positive. And then I just slowly, up through meeting people and being in the world, I realized that what was more important, at least to me, was what was going on out there rather than what was going on in here. And most of the time we are out there, we're not in here.
Wow. We hope you're enjoying this conversation as much as we are. We just wanted to take a quick moment and say thank you to all of our listeners. Your support helps us to keep the lights on and the mics hot.
We recently made the switch to Substack so we could build a more robust listener community. Visit widerlenspod.com and check out the different subscription tiers.
For just $8 a month, premium subscribers get access to weekly bonus content, discussion posts, and more.
And founding members get the inside track on who's coming up to the show, with the ability to submit their own questions for our esteemed guests.
For those of you who are in need of parenting support and resources, we each have parent coaching membership groups. Plus, you can buy our book, When Kids Say They're Trans.
And if you're watching this on YouTube, don't forget to like and subscribe, and get involved in the lively discourse in the comments section.
Thank you so much. Now back to the show. So to kind of reflect what I'm hearing, you were in a period of extreme isolation. Your the most really important relationship in your life ostensibly was terrible and falling apart. You were in another country. You couldn't really communicate with anyone. And through fleeing Japan and coming back to the UK, kind of getting back into real life pulled you out of it to some degree. Like, is that an accurate representation of what you just shared?
Yeah. Yeah, and it was slow. It wasn't immediate when I came back, but it was down to the people I met, I spoke to, and just realizing, like, yeah, there's other things than everything that's going on in here. Everything that's going on in here is temporary for the most part, and, you know, I don't feel... And also, the other part of it as well is I kind of started to realize through conversations with people and hearing what I was saying that the idea of me actually knowing what I was feeling was kind of silly. So I guess to put that to a parable, I think is the word, is if someone was addicted to a substance, but they had no idea what that substance was, they had just been addicted to it, how would they know what the source of that feeling was? They wouldn't. It would be completely, you know, kind of erroneous and arbitrary. So that's kind of how I came around to thinking of it. It's like, I don't know the source of this thing. I don't know what being female means. So how can this feeling mean that? This feeling probably means something else, but it's become through maybe, you know, through whatever, it's become locked away in that idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can I ask, because I know a lot of parents listen to our show, and, you know, I'd like to know what age you were when you came back to England, and what did other people reach you? Did your loved ones reach you, or was it something that you did on your own? Because I know parents would be tearing their hair out thinking, what were the magic words that was said to you that somebody somewhere reached you, because they're trying to reach their kids who are similarly escaping? Because this is what you were doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think towards kids is where it really concerns me, because I do genuinely think that, you know, adults should be able to do whatever they want with their bodies. I don't even think that's an argument, to be completely honest. It's more the people who... I think it comes down to what I said about environment. Kids can't change their environment. So if you can't change your environment, then they're not allowed to. It's just the way the world works. They are living within someone else's, I guess you could say, matrix. They are, you know, they're living within this paradigm. And they have no choice in what their environment is. So how can they possibly know who they are when they can't even choose what they're doing? That's kind of what I really think the best thing to be is supportive, unfortunately, is the only thing you can be. There is no magic words. There's, you know, get experiences, make sure that they're, you know, out in the world. Try not to make it a carrot on a stick, because I feel like that's the tragedy, I think, of the waiting times is, on one hand, it's supposed to make everyone think about it. On the other hand, it just makes you against the government. It makes you against the system, and I am going to get this thing and they can't stop me. So I really just don't know. I wish there was a simple answer. There's not. It's just be kind and be supportive, because the worst thing you could do is get angry, because you'll just, any teenager will double down if you get angry or tell them not to do something.
I know you're saying kids, you know, kids can't change their environment, but it's like you inadvertently, you know, didn't transition in a different environment. If you'd stayed, for example, maybe in Japan.
Oh, I think I would have. 100% yeah. I would have.
And what would have happened then? What would be your position then?
I have a feeling that I would, I thought about it a lot, and I can't help shaking the feeling that I would be exactly where I am now, but with the inability to have children. And honestly, I think that once it's done, and I think you've committed to it, I think most people would stick with it. So I don't necessarily think I would detransition. I think that it would, I just think I would, I would have come to the exact same realizations, but I would have changed my entire body. So I would still be, you know, I'd still be me, but I would have done irreversible things to myself. So it's in the end, I guess it's like it made no difference either way, except I would have lost something making one decision.
You know, Stella, I've heard you talk a lot about regret and how regret is actually a very challenging to arrive at, because once you've invested time and energy making some major transformation to your life, you have incentives to stick with it. I mean, to speak of incentives. So it's interesting to hear you say that. Can I ask, you know, in Japan, I know you were pretty isolated, but had you transitioned there, would there have been people in your life who you felt you had to save face around? Like, do you think coming back to the UK almost gave you like an old fresh start in a way to get out of it? Because we have seen that with young people, sometimes a change in their environment is what it requires to help get them thinking clearly and get out of it. So I'm curious about how did the move impact that?
I mean, it was different because I suddenly wasn't around all the people I'd come out to. So I guess that's kind of peer pressure was gone. Of you've already made the decision, you have to go through with it. I think it was just also just being able to talk to people and the huge change and the realize that I wasn't alone and I didn't have to basically have conversations with myself all day. So it's I think it really was just the change of environment.
Wow. And how were your family? Were they supportive of your transition?
They were. They were confused and they probably wanted to say more than they could. But the implications when someone's transitioning, it's you know, like I said in the Daily Mail article, it is like society has a gun to its head in some point, in some respects. You're not allowed to talk about this thing logically. You're not allowed to talk about it functionally. You have to stay into this emotional argument. And if you don't stay in this emotional argument, and if you don't accept their argument, you're causing people to, you know, you're causing harm to people. Sorry, I have to be careful. I don't want to. Yeah. You're causing harm to people. And I feel like that's a very unfair way of setting it up. And it's also very, very, very convenient for the pharmaceutical companies that the argument is set up in such a way where you're not allowed to say anything about their incentives. It's kind of, yeah.
We want to take a moment to thank our sponsors, Genspect and Therapy First. Genspect is an international organization committed to fostering a healthy approach to sex and gender. The team and members of Genspect strive to promote high-quality, evidence-based care for gender nonconforming individuals. Genspect is pleased to offer a non-medicalized approach to gender with their recently published Gender Framework, and they continue to hold conferences around the world. Visit genspect.org to learn more.
Therapy First is a non-profit worldwide professional association of mental health providers who view psychotherapy as the appropriate first-line treatment for gender dysphoria. Therapy First supports psychotherapists working with gender dysphoric youth and young adults and offers public education on mental health and psychotherapy. Visit therapyfirst.org to learn more.
Now, back to the show. I'm just remembering the Daily Mail article. You did allude to this, how like your family was supportive and almost too supportive. I'm interested in that because I think that on one hand, there is a lot of societal pressure to behave a certain way when a loved one shares that they're transitioning. And I also think people can have a loving, direct conversation with their child, their best friend, their spouse, whatever, to say, I'm actually very concerned about this. This is coming out of the blue or whatever. So in hindsight, have you thought much about what you would like your parents to have said or your very close friends or relatives? Like, what could they have said that wouldn't have been totally inflammatory, but also not just like, go ahead, honey, whatever you got to do?
I think the thing that helped me was someone talking to me about it and then just repeating back what I said. But in like a context, and I remember kind of at my situation specifically, I remember kind of starting to see this thought process that I had that it just didn't make sense. And then I started it started unraveling. And I think that was what it is. It's like, it's almost just okay, so what you're saying is, and then you go through and you say it and it kind of, I think for a lot of people when they hear what they're actually saying back, they might think twice about it. But I think it does have to be delivered in the right way. And I think it has to be kind of, you know, by a friend or something. It's difficult for your parents to say that because when you're younger, your parents, for a lot of people, especially someone rebelling, are always wrong. So it becomes harder. It becomes more just what I think it is. The answer is maybe in some degree to actually just repeat what they're saying and lay out kind of a logical framework for it. And yeah, I think the logical argument is something that needs to be made a little bit more. I think the emotional one is valid and important, but I don't know if it can push the conversation forward in any like meaningful way.
And was this a friend who said that, you know, who basically reframed, kind of a good therapist would do the same, they'd reframe and say back?
It was actually, well, my now current girlfriend, but at the time, who we were just friends, but she helped me through with a lot of the stuff speaking about it.
Nice.
Oh, that's amazing, actually.
Yeah, that's kind of beautiful. And did you like you were gung ho to transition? You'd socially transitioned in Japan, then you came back to England.
To some degree. I was still wearing male clothes, but yeah. Okay. I was still wearing male clothes, but I was painting my nails, I was doing makeup, I was wearing body shaping stuff, but I was probably about a week away from starting to wear female clothes.
And when you came
were
back,
you in you private? Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry to ask. Go ahead. Were you in private wearing female clothes?
Yeah, more so. But that's more like practicing, I guess, one would say. Yes, I was a little bit.
Okay.
And then you came back to England, and did you say, I'm going to transition? And did people say, well, what's stopping you wearing dresses, for example?
No, because I was actually, when I came back to England, I was dressing kind of like casual feminine, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I was already moving towards it. So I think people kind of could see that in the way that I was dressing and the things I was doing. And like I said, I was wearing a corset every day. So that was, yeah, because in an attempt to shape my body.
And what was the time period of, let's say, you coming back and then having this conversation, which sounds really quite pivotal, with your friend?
Probably. 2 to 3 months would be the time frame that it took me to get myself out of it. And in that time, I came out to a lot of people. There was a lot going on, but yeah, it was probably about 2 to 3 months.
And then how did you reverse the shift?
Well, I didn't. I mean, I will always have a slight thing from a corset, but you know what? It makes me skinnier anyway. I didn't start the hormones. The reason I didn't start the hormones was because I was waiting to make sure I had more than a month's supply, because there's nothing worse if you're going to transition than stopping and starting. So, in a way, as I said in the article, the NHS kind of saved me with their slowness.
Yeah, you're not the first who said that to me. Do you know what I mean? And yet the waiting list can be this tantalizing, let me at it. But some people just, and yeah. You said it comes back to you. So gender dysphoria comes back.
I mean, I still sometimes get bouts of it, but I've realized now it's not really that. It's just the emotion of, I really don't want to be me right now. Mm. And that's kind of what it actually is. Because I feel like it just got, for whatever reason, maybe to do with what happened to me as a kid, I don't know. But it just got stuck to this idea of gender. But actually, I think the feeling is just much more, I want to not be in my body at this time, would be a more accurate way of describing it, at least for me.
Yeah. So when you're feeling at war with yourself, or when you're feeling kind of a self-rejection, the default place your brain goes is, I'd like to be a girl. I'd like to be a woman.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'd like to not be me. I would like to be female. I'd like to remove all of this and be a new person, be different. But it's kind of, you know, to say a feeling has that many specifics to it is silly. It's more broad and general than that. It's like a yearning. It's like a pain inside.
Oh.
But it happens when, like I said, it only happens when, when there's incredible moments of stress or incredible moments of sadness. And I think it's combined with, in a way, with the PTSD I have, so it all kind of hits at the same time in this very confusing kind of mind storm. It's very hard to put my finger on specifically what it is, but the longer that goes on for, the more I just want to not be in myself.
Mm. Do you think that part of the reason that you have chosen not to move forward, I mean, in addition to like getting out in the world, realizing that there's more out there than just you, but do you think part of it is also what you said earlier, which is, if I transitioned, I'd still be in the same place. I would just have made changes to my body. So it sounds like there's a part of you that recognizes, you know what, no matter what I do, I can't actually escape being me. Like, I will always be me and I will always have these feelings. Like, do you think that's part of what keeps you grounded in your male identity?
Yes. Yeah, I would think so. And also, it's the other thing of, you know, this moment that people who are transitioning are working towards. It's a postcard. It's a moment. It's, what do you do? Okay, so you've got all this stuff and you've done all this. Well, who are you now? Mm-hmm. Like, you can't just, that's not an identity. An identity is, as a human, that's not an identity. It's, what do you do? What do you do now? You spent, you know, especially if you're a younger person, you spent your entire teenage years focusing on becoming this thing. But that's a, you know, that's a moment. It's a moment in time. That's one moment where you are that thing. But now, what do you do? Like, this is, yeah. And I think that's how I think about it. It's more, I'd rather focus on the things I'm doing now that there are things to do.
Yeah. It feels like there was nothing to do really in Tokyo except escape.
Well, it wasn't that it was... Yeah, there was nothing to do socially, and there was nothing to do in a way that made me happy, like general day to day. It's you know, one example I think of is that there's that scientific study where they took two mice and they got them both addicted to cocaine. One of them had nothing in their cage except for a water bottle with cocaine in it, and it did that until it died. The other one had the exact same thing, but it had all of this amazing, you know, all these like hamster wheels, all toys and stuff for it to play with, and it would only occasionally go and do it. And then it would go and have fun in its cage. So I do think that's, you know, that's a kind of hard thing to put exactly in there, but I do think that's kind of relevant in the fact that you need to make sure that you are happy in your place. Otherwise, you will always go towards the source of self-destruction in one way or another.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to have a full life beyond just the thing you're obsessing over.
Yeah. Exactly. And as I said, for young people, then they've literally just spent all of those years when they should be learning stuff, should be getting new skills, focusing on becoming something.
Mm-hmm.
And where do you go from there? I mean, I think a lot of people will see a lot of cases coming forwards in the few years where people will have that exact problem of, I thought this would solve all my problems, but it turns out the world is actually still there.
Yeah. You mentioned before we started recording, talking about trends. And I think this is very interesting because you have, you know, obviously one part of you in the fashion industry and crypto and tech stuff, and I'm sure other things that I don't know about from reading your bios and stuff. But what are the trends that you wanted to talk about on the program? This is interesting.
Yeah, so I think that if you look at anything, I kind of spoke about earlier how you have the early adopters that come to something. So anything new, any new thing, and medically transitioning is a new thing. It's socially transitioning, obviously, has existed for whatever. It's a different argument. But medically transitioning in the way we do now, that's new. So the first group of people, you know, with any trend, the first group of people benefit from it. They're doing it for honest reasons. Then you have the second wave of people who still probably benefit from it and still probably doing it for honest reasons. But then slowly we see these societal accolades that these people get. We see all of these things. And then other people will look at it, and rather than coming from the honest feeling of, oh, I want to transition or something like that, their feeling will be, well, something's wrong with me and this person fixed it by doing this, so I'm going to do this too. And as stuff grows and grows and grows, there's more and more people who do that. It's and then the chances for mistakes go up. As more people do something, the chances for people to it not be right for them, and the reasons that originally people were doing it for are lost. And now it's just this kind of this kind of trend that people want to, you know, people want to make their lives better. And to a lot of people, that seems a way of making their life better. And it's, they may come from a misguided angle. The fashion industry itself, I mean, a lot of the trends within, I think a lot of people think that marketing creates the market, when it's actually the other way around. I mean, all of these adverts that are, you know, dedicated towards trans people, in my opinion, the marketers are making them for one of two reasons. One, they believe that it will sell to their demographic. Or for the much more cynical reason is Gillette, for instance, doesn't need to sell any more razors. They just need to spend their marketing budget. So no matter what we do, people are going to continue to buy our razors because we sell razors. So we may as well try something crazy that gets everyone talking about our brand. And we don't know if we're going to harm anyone for it. We don't know if we're going to cause a massive cultural thing. But the marketer is just like, let's get as many eyes on our product as possible. So they don't, you know, they're not, these massive marketing firms are not stupid. They're doing it for a reason. They know exactly what they're doing. Whether it's to, you know, to sell a product that frankly always is sold anyway, just in some new interesting way or something like that. And I think, yeah, a lot of, I do feel that there's a lot of people in very sad situations in their lives and in the hardest part of their lives that are basically being used as pawns for marketing, pharmaceutical companies, political arguments, all of this stuff. And we're forgetting the human element that, you know, there are people, you know, from whatever view you come from, there are people either ruining their lives or dying because of this. And all that's happening is there's a trend, there's this, you know, overarching idea. No one actually wants to solve the conversation. Because also, I'm jumping all over the place, but the other thing is, you know, like, if you look at, for instance, the pronouns argument, right?
Okay.
Nobody in polite society in a social setting is not going to use someone's pronoun. Even people like Ben Shapiro, who are that far on the issue, said socially, I will use people's pronouns because people are not rude. So this argument is just political grandstanding because virtually everyone in a social context would do it anyway. So like, that's what I mean. It seems like there's an incentive to never solve this argument going on because we're arguing about inconsequential things in the end.
Well, maybe they are the circles you're in.
Yeah, you don't know our circles. There's a lot of non-pronoun users. And a lot of pronoun users. I mean, it's actually a huge debate, and we've gotten in trouble for using people's pronouns with some of our listeners. So it's,
I will always call people by their name if they ask. But also, if someone wants to be called something, I'm not so rude. I will just, of course, there's no, mm-hmm. you know, I don't mm-hmm. think there should be legal repercussions if someone does something impolite. But it is just polite to be polite. That's kind of mm-hmm. where I land on, like, specifically that one.
Yeah. You know, you talk about it in a very, it's a very, almost a computerized way of
been in the computer too long.
Well, that's exactly what I'm wondering. I'm wondering two things. I'm wondering, were you on the computer a huge amount as you were growing up? And also, how influential were those online rooms you went into? Tell us a little bit about that, because I don't think people really know what goes down in those online rooms that go from people just visit to suddenly people become completely transfixed of this is the solution. So I'd like to hear a bit about that.
So I think when I was younger, when I was thinking about it, they were just kind of random forums with transgender stuff on them. I don't think it was like one particular place. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing like some YouTube videos and things like that, but nothing overly specific. When it was this time around, it was the, you know, the M2F, r/M2F, r/egg, all of these sort of places. And these are like, the paradigm that they present there is like, oh, you like strategy games? Well, you're trans. It's like literally anything. You picked an orange today rather than a banana. Oh, trans, definitely. And it's kind of like, you know, you start to read all of these solutions where it's just everything is just, yeah, and obviously it was this. It's kind of like, this can't solve everything. But when you're getting into it, you believe it. You believe the thing. And you think, oh, these people understand. And you read the stories and these people get it. And, you know, I'm sure there are some older people on those forums who mean well. But I'm sure that there is also some older people in those forums who don't mean well and have all sorts of reasons for doing what they're doing. Like, you know, going back to Transmaxers, I interviewed the leader of that, and his motivation was to essentially sterilize incels. So, and that's all on camera. That's all on recorded. You can see it online. But yeah, so there are people running these groups with some mad intentions.
Wow.
And I think
and
we
are
have
they
to
very
realize,
influential? Are those
well, he the Transmaxer one specifically, he, you know, looks after a Discord of 1,800 people. But just by him existing, if that one person exists with that one idea, then there's probably more people like that. You know, we can extrapolate from that there would be more people. That's concerning. I think because also the people who even the people who mean well, what they're doing is they're projecting their personal experience onto younger people, and their experience is unique to them. The reasons that they want to transition and the ages they did it at were unique to them. To project that onto someone else is kind of, you know, almost anti the trans argument in the fact that there is a unique reason for everyone to transition for every person. So your unique lived experience is not going to be benefited by someone else's unique lived experience. That's the way I put it.
Yeah. And we interviewed another young male recently who transitioned as a child, and he shared with us that he spent a lot of time in these online rooms where he was really groomed in a sexual and perverse way by older men. And that was another kind of version of wanting to escape something about sexuality, feeling dirty, feeling icky. So there's a lot here about these online spaces. You know, as we come towards the end, I'm sure Stella has more questions, but one thing that I wanted to ask is, you went through this, it seems like, somewhat privately. Of course, your immediate family and friends knew what was going on, and you could have just moved forward. You're obviously in the public eye to some degree. You could have just moved forward and left this behind you, but you chose to speak about it. So I imagine you have really important messages or things you want people to understand about your story.
That's actually, I'm glad you said that, because that is something I wanted to clarify. Was I didn't actually reach out to the Daily Mail. They reached out to me. I initially wasn't trying to go out there and speak about this. They were writing what I assume was going to be a hit piece about me. And I, rather than allowing it to be Sasha Bailey runs away from wife, something like that, I thought I would use the opportunity to tell them what really happened, because I wanted to help other people. So I didn't go to the press with this. I think a lot of people think I did, but I didn't. And so it was also with the dispute I was in, it felt like it was going to come out sooner or later. So I'd rather it came out on my terms. So that's, I didn't, I should have said that at the beginning. I didn't go out there, but I want other people to not feel the loneliness that I felt. I want people to know, like me, it isn't the only option. I also want people to think about, you know, changing their environment, changing things around them. In the end, all I really want is people to not feel the way I felt. And if my voice or the things I'm saying can help with that, that's great.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I do want to ask you, is there anything you'd recommend, whether you're listening or watching or any podcasts or films or books that you're excited by at the moment?
I'm excited by at the moment. Well, I'm reading The Culture, but it's a sci-fi.
Why am I not surprised?
It's actually kind of loosely about these topics. It's about people... as the future goes on, people doing more and more extreme body modification until there are giraffe people and there are this, and it actually explores a lot of these topics. And it starts out with, you know, the initial part of it is just the idea that men will transition to women and women will transition to men. And, you know, this is written a while ago. And then as it progresses, the story, you know, it becomes more and more weird until basically humanity is not humanity anymore. And I do think on a cosmic grand scale, I think a lot of these arguments will fall by the wayside once technology progresses to a certain point. But that's not now. That's a long way away.
Could you just say
what maybe we should move this to the exclusive content, but that sounds extraordinary what you just said there.
It's almost like a transhumanism kind of theme, I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, I honestly do think eventually with, you know, body fat modification, cybernetics, all of that stuff, our physical bodies will probably become irrelevant to a lot of people. But I don't know, you know, technology comes in leaps and bounds. God knows how far away that is. But you do look at some bionic arms now, and they're getting to the point where it's not that long until they'll be better than regular arms. And then we might be having the conversation of someone wanting some sort of attachment for their arm, but they want it because they want it. So when that happens, I don't know if we'll be making the argument that I feel like this attachment. I think it will be like, I want this attachment, say a drill attachment, because I want to be able to drill things better. And I do think eventually that, you know, we're a very long way away from that. But I also think that's probably where a lot of the people in tech's minds are too. They're already living in that reality.
Yeah. Well, wow. I think for our general audience, we will wrap it up here. I actually have lots of thoughts about what you just said. So I want to keep this conversation going in the exclusive content. We'll be sure to include the Daily Mail article. And then if there are, you know, if you want to share with us more about the book, The Culture, we'd love to include that in the notes. And if there's anywhere else that you want people to follow up with you, like where can people go to learn more about you or your crypto work or other things?
So I'm on Twitter at Sasha Bailey and Instagram at Sasha Bailey. What I do kind of day to day is I report a nonprofit for the kind of crypto community and stuff on FOMA Mag, which stands for Fear of Missing Art, and that's at FOMA Mag. If you want to learn about digital art and that whole kind of movement over the last 4 or 5 years, that's the place to go. It's quite technical, and you know, I wouldn't recommend it for everyone, but it's there. I also did do an issue called Fake, because someone got angry at our magazine and said FOMA's a fake magazine, so I thought that was just funny. So there's an issue called Fake, which actually is about all these topics. So it's less, I don't think there's actually any crypto in it at all. It's just about these concepts of, during my kind of recovery process, I wrote it, and it's called How to Be a Man, and it's basically interviews with all sorts of people from all sorts of walks of life.
Oh, lovely.
On that sort of viewpoint. So it's definitely worth checking out.
That's fascinating. Lovely. We'll definitely include that. Thank you so much, Sasha.
Yeah, I really,
my pleasure.
I really felt like I've encountered somebody, I don't know, almost from the future with you. But thanks very much. That was really fascinating.
My pleasure.
Thanks for joining us this week on Gender, A Wider Lens.
If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
And be sure to visit us on Substack by going to widerlenspod.com. There you can join our listener community, access bonus content and resources, plus learn about additional ways to support the show.
Our discussions are for educational purposes and are not intended as a substitute for mental health services.